Coming up on Life is a Festival.
How am I going to get a job?
I know, exactly. And that question is a good example of, is that the best question that serves you? Because if we really dig into that question, how can I get a job? A job is something that's often a predefined work description. There's an existing role that you try to fit yourself into, and get sort of presupposes that you're trying to earn it or someone else grants it for you. Whereas if we were to change and reframe that question, how can I craft the right role or something for me? Our default is that we're trying to compete and qualify for these pre-assigned roles that we're all clamoring for and trying to edge each other out on. That's sort of the scarcity zero-sum game. There's only so many roles and so many people competing for them. Another way to view it is that each person has some inherent special gift, and really they're there to craft some sort of form of play or service or work that fits their role. And some of the best companies I've seen, when they identify people with wonderful X factor, they will craft the role for that person, even if it's not a pre-existing job title.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hey, what's up, party people? I'm in London. I am in merry Christmas time London. I just last night did my live episode at Spotify headquarters with my good friend Marcus Barnes, and I'm happy to report that it went really well. I've never done a live podcast before. I did one at the radio at BMIR at Burning Man, but this was in front of an audience in an office late afternoon. And, you know, these podcasts, they can kind of be a little stiff to start. And I think it took me a little while to get in the pocket. But like always, we got a little shared vulnerability, we got a little humor. And by the end of the show, I really felt like Spotify had gotten their money's worth. So I feel good about that and so grateful for this opportunity to be out here for Spotify. I'll be going next week to Stockholm to do another live podcast there with great friend of the show and the guest of episode 2, Gustav Tada, one of the organizers of the Nordic Burn. And both of those podcasts will be live in the coming weeks. Okay, so today on the show, we are talking about something that is pretty hard for me, and that is professional work. As you will hear, I share a lot about my own self, and I talk about my own financial situation, which I've never spoken about on this podcast before, but I think it's important to share both the privilege that has allowed me to do what I've done and build this podcast, but also where I'm at now in my life. On the show, I'm talking to my friend Tim Chang, and Tim is just the best dude to talk about this with. So Tim is a managing partner of a venture firm called Mayfield, and he's not like your typical VC bro-y dude just trying to make all the bucks. Tim is the child of Taiwanese immigrants. He's a philosopher. He's a burner. He's a very spiritual man with a meditation practice. I mean, he's just, well, you'll hear. He's rad. On the show, we talk about self-worth, external validation, what it means to craft your own role rather than the typical kind of get a job. We talk about Tim's formula for a beautiful life, which goes by the acronym of TIM. That's hilarious. We also talk about diversity in venture capital, and we make space to talk about VC-backed psychedelic medicine, which is something that I'm pretty concerned about. I'm wondering what's going to happen here as these medicines that are so poignant and valuable in our lives can potentially be co-opted by big pharma or go the kind of VC unicorn model. I'm a little worried about it, and Tim has some ideas. So we also end the podcast with Tim's band, which is called Black Mahal, and there's a remix by Pants Party. So that's like a nice juicy ending bit. Finally, so Tim has suggested to me, as some of you have suggested to me, to create a Patreon and actually allow listeners of the show to support me. Well, you are in luck because today I'm launching my Patreon. So if you've always wanted to throw a fiver in my digital tip jar, that digital tip jar is up. Like many aspects of this podcast, this is going to be an iterative relationship between me and you. So the first tier is just, you like my work, throw me a fiver. Super simple. Middle tier, I'm going to work with some exclusive content and try to produce something, maybe extra juicy vulnerability, you know, vulnerability on demand for money. It's on brand. And then I want to give the opportunity to a special few of you to go full on Medici, which is a high tier. You give me a chunk of money. It's not like a crazy chunk, but it's a chunk. And that really helps me on the windy path towards financial sustainability. And in exchange, you get some exclusive content. But also, we can talk about the show in a kind of formal way. Like, you're my patron and I'm doing the show. That's kind of what I'm starting with now, but I would love your feedback. So, you know, as always, if you want to join the Life is a Festival Facebook group, that's where we're usually talking about the show, but you can also reach me directly through my website. That's AimonArmstrong.com. So, a bit of a longer preamble today on this cloudy, lovely, cold London day, but here we go with Tim Chang. I think you're really going to like this. Okay, so Tim, we're just going to start recording.
I love it. It's great.
I want to catch up with you. I want to talk about things, but you're going to say something brilliant and then it's not going to be recorded. So we're going to do levels. Can I get some levels from you?
Testing. 1, 2, 1, 2. Check.
Do you like to shout?
No, I may get excited here and there, but usually pretty.
You don't seem like a shouter.
No.
You're more of a meditator than a shouter.
Yeah,
really.
Try to be. Except when I lose my keys, then I'm like,
Isn't it funny, the tiny little annoyances.
Tiny little annoyances.
As I was thinking about this podcast, when we first discussed doing one, we wanted to address this idea of our relationship to money and career and worth and value in the world, which is so important.
Absolutely.
There's a whole nother conversation I want to have,
which
is, you're in the VC world.
Yes.
And I'm extremely interested in what is happening with psychedelic medicine.
Yep.
So I want to launch into that probably towards the end of the conversation.
For sure.
Because this audience is a pretty psychedelic friendly.
Absolutely.
So what would a real zinger win home run podcast be for you today?
Wow. A zinger win podcast would probably be something where we both learn something and maybe come up with new ideas on the fly. You know, I like to go into this really curious, but also not pretending to have any of the answers. If anything, if we come up with better questions, that would be a winner, because then those would be rabbit holes we can dive down for future sessions and go explore with folks we know. So I've always believed that questioning is the answer, right? Prescriptions are deadly. And so what you really want is refinement of your questions, because better questions tend to serve you better in terms of just sort of the insight you gain from them. But the art of forming and asking and refining questions is sometimes sort of a lost art in and of itself. Like, I learned this actually working with the XPRIZE crew. The amount of time they spend in formulating the challenge is absolutely crucial to the success of that project. It's kind of like that garbage in, garbage out sort of thing. Similarly, even in self-inquiry, like let's say you're sitting down for meditation or some other practice of self-inquiry, how you do your set and setting, the question you set up for yourself, if that question doesn't serve you, then the process, the journey won't necessarily lead to the insights that are helpful. An example of a question that doesn't serve you: why am I never blah, blah, blah? How come I always blah, blah, blah? You know, like, that already has such bias built into the question that it's worth asking, does this question really serve me best?
Well, and in alignment with today's theme, a question I've asked myself many times in my life is, how can I get a job?
Right.
You know, and when I think to myself, how can I get a job? I think of cubicles. I think of long days with weird working lunch breaks. I think of working on someone else's project that I don't believe in. Ugh, how am I going to get a job?
I know, exactly. And that question is a good example of, is that the best question that serves you? Because if we really dig into that question, how can I get a job? Get is one portion, and then get a job, that's another portion to look at as well. A job is something that's often a predefined work description. There's an existing role that you try to fit yourself into, and get sort of presupposes that you're trying to earn it or someone else grants it for you.
And you have to compete with others to be like, I need to get this job. How can I possibly measure up to all these imaginary people who I imagine to be better than me?
Exactly. Whereas if we were to change and reframe that question, how can I craft the right role or something for me? So that's one way to view it, is our default is that we're trying to compete and qualify for these pre-assigned roles that we're all clamoring for and trying to edge each other out on. That's sort of the scarcity zero-sum game. There's only so many roles and so many people competing for them. Another way to view it is that each person has some inherent special gift, and really they're there to craft some sort of form of play or service or work that fits their role. And some of the best companies I've seen, when they identify people with wonderful X factor, they will craft the role for that person, even if it's not a pre-existing job title. I had that happen once in my life, and it was a wonderful learning moment to realize, oh, wait, maybe I can craft my own job, like even craft my own major in school or university too. Right.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily have to be an entrepreneur going at it alone to design a life that you really enjoy.
That's right. I totally agree with that. In fact, sometimes what's really powerful, even when you're talking to a company, the difference between going in to a potential employer and asking, so what can I do for you? And for them to kind of respond, well, I don't know, what can you do for me? Versus you come in and say, I see these three things that you're not doing that I could weave together for you, and here's how I would do it. You know what I mean? That's almost more sort of like brainstorming or coming in with a proactive approach of what you'd want to do for an organization, as opposed to what role? Well, what roles do you have open for me? You know?
So life is a festival, and a huge amount of our lives at this stage in our human evolution is spent working.
Yes.
Working either as an entrepreneur, or working as an artist, working for patronage, working for money, working for a bed to sleep in, for meals. And so how we find our relationship to our ikigai, the Japanese Venn diagram of how to find your purpose.
Yes.
What are the four pieces of ikigai? Do you recall?
I don't recall what I have. I know exactly.
Yeah. So it, I think it's what will pay me.
Yes.
What the world needs, what I'm good at,
and
what I enjoy.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's your ikigai. Yes. And that's we need to craft that in our lives. And even the adventure of crafting it is can be a festival.
Totally.
Tim's a perfect person to have this conversation. And so where I'd like to start is, Tim, why are you the perfect person to have this conversation? Let's talk a little bit about your background. See, Tim just made a face, a very humble face. But what I mean by that is, you know, your life story, how you got to where you are, your role in as a venture capitalist, as someone who is helping these companies grow and expand, and also your connection to spirituality, meditation, the Burning Man world. You are, in my view, the best person of everyone that I know to have this conversation. So let's locate the audience a little bit with you.
Sure.
And let's start with, how'd you grow up?
Thank you for asking. And I'm really humbled and honored you'd consider me qualified for that role. This is a deeply personal story for me. Honestly, I never thought I'd be a venture capitalist. I didn't even know what that was growing up. And maybe that's an example of how we often sort of fall into or craft, you know, sort of roles that fit us, that journey for us. I grew up as the son of immigrant graduate students, came to the country without a whole lot of money. I was basically an accidental kid. You know, I don't think I was planned. My parents were in grad school, coming in as first generation immigrants.
They were. And where were you?
This was in California, in San Diego. My father was getting his PhD at UCSD, you know, young 20 somethings, freshly married, and boom, you know, they got pregnant. I don't think I was planned. And when you're a starving immigrant graduate student, you know, supporting a kid's probably not high on your priority list. So I wasn't intended. I think it's always carried something within me that I've always had this sort of bit of imposter syndrome inside, sort of like, am I supposed to be here? Do I belong here? Am I wanted here?
Do you still have that?
It's something I think I wrestled with and integrated in with a lot of self-work over time, but there was always a hint there, you know? And another part of my background story is I'm actually descended from some pretty interesting people. My great-grandfather helped to co-found modern-day Taiwan. He literally was a nation builder. And then my grandfather served as head of the Ministry of Finance of Taiwan as it rose up in prominence. And those are some pretty big shoes to fill. So part of, again, this imposter syndrome is like, whoa, what am I going to do to follow up on those acts, right?
Do you feel like growing up, your parents had a view that you needed to succeed in a certain way? Is there a sort of lineage of success that you need to step in line of?
I think I placed that upon myself. Growing up, honestly, we were in scarcity survival mode, you know? Like, I think my parents literally had to get by in a couple hundred bucks a month as poor grad students. And so it was sort of save, scrimp, don't spend, that very frugal mentality. And I think in that mindset, for especially many immigrants on the academic path, the holy grail is just get good grades. and the world will take care of you. Get good grades so you can get into a good school. Get into a good school so you can get a good job. There's that word again, right? And because it's really playing for external validation and to just play the game to make sure that you can pay your rent, have a house, that sort of thing, right? So I was bought into that because I was raised that way. Doesn't exactly encourage risk-taking or entrepreneurship, but I always had creative urges in myself. I grew up in East Lansing Public Library, reading books of faraway places and fairy tales and all that
sort of
thing.
I love faraway places.
Right? So there's that again. But, you know, my first love was like collecting comic books and programming video games and designing my own board games because I was, you know, too poor to buy the Milton Bradley Battleship ones. So I'd get like Elmer's glue and construction paper and cardboard and make my own and craft my own rules and stuff. And so a lot of it was that creativity out of necessity. I didn't feel poor back then. I knew, you know, we couldn't afford the same things a lot of the other neighborhood kids had, but it was a wonderful way to find creativity as a way to go explore that, right? But within that, it was all about just get good grades. And that was the thing. I remember coming home once and saying, "Mom, I got 97% in the chemistry test," and only to be met with the response of, "Well, what happened to the other 3 points?" You know, and so that, I think, put me on this path of always seeking external validation. And it was always sort of, how to win approval from others. And so I never really thought to myself, what do I want? What would be neat for me? And what could I craft myself? It was always just qualifying for the best, get into the best, look for that external validation. And so, you know, I played that game. It was about getting grades to get into a good college, then figure out some major that would pay you well. And even then, though, I think I started cracking and rebelling because although engineering was the way to get, you know, kind of a good paycheck potentially as a major, I spent all my spare time rebelling, and I was in music clubs playing with my band or on stage doing acting or all these other creative pursuits, right? Probably much to my parents' chagrin because they thought that'd be a waste of time or a distraction. That'll never pay the rent, you know, that sort of thing.
The external validation piece, which I share, I think is part of this whole idea of worth and money and success. Because if you were look out at the world and you're trying to get this scarce resource, which is external love, external validation, external praise, you're kind of seeing the world as a collection of these assets to acquire. And they're intangible, but you're sort of seeing the world that way. If you're internally resourced and you yep. feel that in your core, then you're playing a far different game when you look out at the world.
Yes.
Because it's much easier to plan, I want to see this. I want to help these people. I want to achieve this. And you can navigate that a little differently because if you want to help these people so that you'll be loved,
yes.
if you want to achieve this so that you'll be loved, there's kind of a different interface that you're experiencing. I know because I mostly experience that interface. And when I don't experience it, I'm just far more effective
yeah.
in my actual goals and what I actually want to do in the world.
Totally. And, you know, let's get real, real about this. I've always wondered if I had some of this sort of like a savior complex or sort of people-pleasing complex, and that probably comes from always growing up seeking external validation. My household wasn't exactly the warmest place. A lot of classic, you know, Asian tiger parents, we have sort of this tough love culture. We don't use phrases like, I love you, I'm proud of you, good job. It's always like, could do more, could do better. We didn't do hugs in the household. So probably always was on a quest seeking that affection, that affirmation, that external validation, right? And it is very different the way you walk and move through the world when you're always looking for approval from others. And even to this day, I genuinely love helping others, but I do try to ask myself how much of that is that selfless desire to help, even if there's no thank you in return, versus how much of that is hoping to be needed, wanted, accepted, right?
And of course, paradoxically, you don't change that dynamic by hating yourself for it
right.
and by being like, oh, I'm so phony or whatever. That's a dead end for yeah. sure. Because what you're trying to do is cultivate self-love.
Right.
And the first step of self-love truly is acceptance for what actually is in this moment.
Right.
You know, so I have a music journalist friend, Jamile, who once referred to my cloying need for external validation.
Mm-hmm.
Cloy is such a great word, this kind of saccharine, sugary sort of thing. And I like that phrase now because I kind of love the wounded boy who needs those things. And I console and heal and care for him when he is behaving his most needy.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, being that parent to my child self and being like, don't be needy, don't need that external validation. I say, oh, okay, what are you not getting? How can I give that to you? How can me, the parent of the adult, of the child in me now, maybe I can give that to you. Maybe we can.
It's beautiful.
You know, we can take care of this inside. And it's taken, as you said, like a lot of self-work to even develop that understanding and then to test it and see that it actually does affect you and actually does help.
I'd go as far as say that is our core and first and foremost real job is to reparent ourselves of that thing we didn't get. And it's ironic too, because there's a saying that we crave most what we were most denied. And so in a way that also can lead to us finding our superpower too, right? You often are most passionate about that which you were fervently denied. And sometimes you discover a way to adapt or get it through that challenge, right? That trauma. And that there then becomes a gift that you can help serve others with. So it's a really interesting kind of paradox to wrestle with is, well, if I grew up fully happy and fully nourished, would I have been less ambitious? Maybe, I don't know. I think my journey has been dysfunctional ambition and high functioning in search of that external validation. It got me to some great places, but the punchline was that I kept trying to do better and better to win all the accolades and get into all the right places, only to find those things didn't satisfy in the end. Ultimately, it's like what you said, to become more internally resourced and just self-accepting, that the ultimate validation couldn't be granted through a diploma, stamp of approval, job title, salary level, etc.
And I know that that is true deeply, and that that's ultimately the real thrust of the journey. And yet, we also do need to earn a living.
Yes.
We do need to create something in this world that sustains us. And so, you know, as you say, maybe if I didn't have this dysfunction or this wound, then I wouldn't have been driven in that way. That's tricky. You know, it's kind of, it's a little bit like, you know, art from poor mental health. You know, maybe if I didn't have this depression, I wouldn't have created this art. In some ways, I find it helpful to look at it one way to say, well, thank you, depression. I am creating this art. I'm grateful for you and I'm healing through this process. But looked at the other way, well, I have to stay depressed or I'm not going to be able to create my art. So I'm not going to do anything to heal my depression because I need to create this art. That's super toxic and very likely untrue.
Right.
And we can take that a similar thing if we talk about this pernicious motif of the starving artist. So maybe I need to be poor to create art. Maybe I need to be not engaged in these systems around me to have authenticity. It's a similar kind of thing.
It very much is. I wrestle with this one all the time. There's that notion of drive and hunger versus, you know, if you're abundantly resourced, does that afford you a way to play and serve in different ways? You know, I wonder a lot about that notion of privilege. Had I grown up like a Trustafarian or something like that, you know, gallivanting the world, not worrying about money, would I have had a different purview on things, you know, versus sort of just looking for approval and just trying to work harder and work at things to win approval for, you know?
So I haven't mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's very important to mention it, which is I do have some family money. I grew up with a lot of privilege. My education was paid for, and it was paid for in such a way that there was extra money left over.
Yeah.
And I literally have used that extra money to gallivant the world, as you say. And so first of all, it's important to share this because when you look at people gallivanting the world on Instagram or whatever, it's important to know that there's different ways that that happens. And
that's
I think we all want to present ourselves as these successful entrepreneurs who are self-made. Everybody does that. But if you're looking at people online, people have different levels of help.
Yeah.
And I will say that, you know, I'm someone who's had some help. It also has its own wounds attached to it.
For sure.
Which is the idea of worthiness around money. So for me, I have a little extra money. Not enough to just live a flamboyant life. You know, I've waited tables for 10 years. While playing music, when I worked for Fest 300, I was living off that. But I have a little nest egg, and recently I took that nest egg and traveled around the world. But something that's part of that privilege is a kind of imposter syndrome as well.
For sure, and it carries its own trauma. And that's one thing I want to be really careful is not to apply too much prejudgment to that privilege. Privilege carries its own trauma, whether it's people not feeling they deserve it or that judgment. And the irony is, I didn't grow up with much. I had to scrap for everything I got. Now I'm in this place of privilege and the judgment I see from that, the resistance is palpable, because it's kind of funny, because in many ways I'm still that, you know, broke 10-year-old kid inside. So I don't feel that, but I have to recognize that and what that represents to folks as well, right? And so just, I'm trying to have more compassion and empathy for everybody's position, because it's, everybody has a struggle. What's that saying? Everyone is fighting a battle you know nothing about, so be kind, right? But in our worlds especially, there's a lot of capitalism trauma for good reason, but you know, again, trying not to apply that judgment too much, that just because someone grew up with privilege, they don't deserve that empathy or understanding that they have challenges too, they face.
Well, yeah. And for me, I always want to pay a little more. I'll get the meal this time. I'll lend you some money. I have a little bit more. And you know, there's a part of me that's full-hearted, abundant, loving, that really just does want to share.
Yes.
And then there's a part of me that is like, I don't deserve this. And also, I don't want to be exposed as this bad person who has help. I've had a hard time stating my worth and saying, I want to be paid this much.
Yeah.
I'll be like, oh, I'm just grateful to be here. It's hard to get a job. It's hard to put yourself out there. And if you have a little extra wiggle room, it's easier to put that off.
Right.
And you can get kind of paralyzed in the fear of, well, you know, I got a little inheritance, or I had something that was successful a little while back, but I don't know how to replicate that success. But I don't have the same urgency to do it. And now the clock's ticking, you know. And
that's right.
That's definitely something that I've experienced in my life.
But you know what I hope is, and I do see you living this out, is because you have had a bit of that wiggle room, you get to experiment, you get to play. And I think through that play, you will craft and find your purpose and in new ways that you never would have imagined before. Whereas sometimes I think when you're weighed down by just scarcity survival mode, it is just getting that first job that comes your way, right? And that's an interesting dance to wrestle with as well. Right? Survival versus that abundance. Both can lead to some pretty extraordinary outcomes, but they have different weights upon them, different pressures.
Well, yeah. And I think that the best thing to do, to me, the moral high ground is not to be one or the other, but to widen your perspective, to have compassion for both.
Yes.
That's, and yes, not even moral high ground, but yep, like that's the appropriate way to hold it. And it's hard because the nature of privilege is what is not seen.
Right.
You know, racial privilege, for example,
right,
white privilege,
right, is male privilege, all these things. Yeah.
White privilege is the color of the Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's white privilege.
Yeah.
I don't notice that because it's the color of me.
Right.
Because it was designed to be the color of me.
Right.
But I don't recognize that Band-Aid is going to look totally different on a different skin tone.
Yeah.
That's privilege. And for me, with class privilege, that's the one I have the most blind spots about. My partner brought something up to me that has been really powerful. My partner had a similar upbringing that you did. And she said, yeah, the Burning Man community is all about inclusion. If you can afford to go to Burning Man.
Right, right.
If you can afford to go to these places,
yep,
everyone's welcoming to you. But don't you see that this barrier to entry financially is by its very nature deeply exclusive? And that's been really revelatory for me in terms of widening my perspective.
Right. And so, and that's, I think, where the answer might lie, is that we push ourselves and each other to keep widening our perspective, to be more inclusive, to take perspectives of others and brainstorm ways to allow others to kind of participate, join that conversation. I think we talked about this before, like scholarship funds that enable tickets to festivals for people who normally couldn't afford it or weren't invited before, right? To spread more of that diversity, programs to foster artists into the community, in even in workplaces, right? To get them in participating and also to recognize the value they bring to companies and communities and locales, right? To do it in a mindful way, so it's not just like, here's your corporate overlords dictating what the artist should do, but to have it be much more inclusive and inviting.
How have you, in your capacity as a venture capitalist, while you're making choices about which horses to back,
yeah,
do you bring in ideas of diversity, and how does that play out for you?
It is something that I've had to really work on actively inserting the dialogue. When I first got into venture capital 20 years ago, it was literally just like, man, I hope I can keep this job. I hope I put some points in the board. Man, I hope I can hang. You know, it's that survival mentality.
And mostly white dudes, right?
Of course. Yeah. And I didn't even feel that comfortable in that environment. I still viewed myself as sort of a wannabe musician that somehow lucked into this job, and only to find out at networking events, I don't like these bros. I don't legit get along with them, and I don't view myself as them. Worse yet, when I meet founders, they now call me the man in a suit. And it was tough because I was like, I'm not that. I'm much more associated as a creative or a founder or an entrepreneur. And so those titles we take, those roles that you pick up, have a lot of weight on them as well. And for me, I never felt comfortable in that. And at first, tried to play into it. Never talked about creative pursuits in work settings, never talked about things like Burning Man. I was trying to compartmentalize my life. I was thinking that people I work with won't take me seriously if they know I'm deeply passionate about music, poetry, performing arts, improv, immersive art at Burning Man. Similarly, I thought the creative community won't take me seriously, or they'll think, you know, I'm an imposter if I talk about my day job and I have this title as a venture capitalist, right? And all that represents. And it was hard. That schism, man. I think ultimately we want to integrate all the parts of ourselves, and that's maybe where the dance is. If you find the mixtape of the things that are divergent but are unique to you, and you find a way to make them flow that's authentic to you, that's pretty unique. And when you can put that together, I think the world and people want to see that, right? So that was when I became more comfortable with my job, was when I stopped trying to have that division and saying, you know what, I do VC by day, but I also play music and I love theater and performing, creative arts. And you know what, maybe I'll weave that more into my day job. And so on the diversity front, it's been even sort of making sure of like, oh, how do we employ, you know, artists for our unconferences? How do we get sketch artists that capture the ideas? How do I get people from other demographics coming and presenting and sharing things? Also, even now saying, how do we make sure the next partner we bring in is a woman of color? And so that was something that we started to implement. But my God, it took a lot of pushing. There were times we almost gave up at Mayfield because that search was almost 3 years long and we were trying desperately to maintain the line of, nope, has to be a woman partner. But, you know, the candidate supply was not as high as we wanted. And that's endemic to what's happening in the Valley and STEM and education and all that, which we need to keep working on as well. But I'm glad we stuck with it because we did find an amazing woman partner. But it required the entire partnership basically signing up and saying, nope, this is the hardline requirement, you know. But that's an example of forcing that discipline into your workplace and luckily having, you know, coworkers that agree with that.
The funding space moves the wheel for all sorts of other things.
Yep.
Because you're making calls on which companies to back.
Yep.
So if it's a bunch of bro-y white dudes, then they're going to back a bunch of bro-y white dudes who are going to build companies that don't necessarily have a perspective of diversity built into them. And then we're going to see externalities down the line when these companies are operating around the world.
Yep.
With these kind of bro-y white guy mentalities.
That's totally right. Healthy investment partnership has diversity of perspectives by design because new ideas come out of left field. So you need people that are open-minded to that because, quite frankly, the biggest hits always sounded like a stupid idea initially. That's why you need that diversity of viewpoints, because if it's all the same kind of bro-y white dude perspective, they'll all just simply have hive mind and say, that doesn't make sense to me. Whereas if it's a young woman partner who has the pulse and the zeitgeist of Gen Z, they might spot that, nope, they're onto something that's new, right? That's why diversity of perspective is so important for capital allocation and stakeholding.
So I want to come back to getting a job.
Yep.
When you and I first decided we were going to do a podcast together, you mentioned to me that you have a particular passion towards helping artists and creative types heal their relationship to money.
Yep.
And self-worth.
Yep.
By virtue of money.
Yep.
And I'm going to meander for one moment to talk about the motif of the starving artist.
Yes.
And it originally comes from a guy named Henri Murger, who wrote an essay about four starving artists, scenes from the life of the Bohemian. And that was the basis for Puccini's opera. And it's an idea that there's an authentic life of an artist, and that is to suffer for your art. I wanted to bring that into the podcast because I wanted to give kind of the trajectory. Anyway, the point is it's a story, and we live our lives based on stories. There's a story that authenticity comes from poverty. Mm. And I think that I've held that story in my life, particularly as a counterbalance to my own privilege, to say, well, my privilege is somehow inauthentic and not real and not of service and not meaningful. But if I'm a starving artist, then I can give to the world. Then I can somehow buck the system. How do we change that story? I mean, should, first of all, should we change that story?
I love this question. This one has haunted me for a long time, especially when I wanted to be more of a professional actor and musician early on. I bought into that story that, man, you need to starve to make good art. And it was because, you know, I'd had favorite artists like Sting or whatnot. And then as they became more successful, you know, commercially, it's like, oh, the music's not quite as good. I think there is something to that. I wonder if we could reframe it more like a hero's journey, that there are different ways to tap into your purpose, your true calling. One of them is pain. Pain comes from austerity, and that starvation keeps you lean, keeps you hungry, forces you to really look at yourself. You're desperate to find that because, you know, what is that? Necessity is the mother of invention, that sort of thing. We have that romance too in Silicon Valley, that the lean startup and you're eating ramen and not sleeping and you're just grinding to make it work. That is a path towards that motivation. What if another motivation, though, could be curiosity and play? I think of Ben Franklin, or I think of Da Vinci. They were just deeply curious people. I'm not sure they were starving the whole time. In fact, I think they were probably pretty well off, but they just had that innate curiosity. Could that be another path towards tuning into that voice, that discovery, that innovation? I'd like to think that's a parallel story we could have as well. I also wonder, too, does it have to mean that the artist is always starving in order to keep making good art? Or could they evolve and level up, and as they progress and start to attract recognition and financial success, that they could still keep going with their path of finding their voice and evolving their work as well? There's got to be a lot of counter cases of artists that start to get some financial success but kept evolving their work too, right?
What I've found is money is energy, and money creates opportunity and collaboration. And I think that if you are hyper-focused on money and you see everyone around you as dollar signs, that's super toxic and unhealthy.
Yes.
And Burning Man is a great example of what life could be like without that. However, at the same time, if you are flourishing, you're demonstrating to others that what you're doing is working. When something becomes financially viable, you're able to employ people, you're able to include others, you're able to pick up certain attention in certain ways. And this matters. This matters to get your art out in the world.
Totally, totally. Let's explore this notion of profit, because that's been a very loaded term. People are like, oh, for-profit, non-profit, you know, that schism. Profit is not inherently bad. Profit, you could say, is the value you add on top of raw resources or time. It's the value you create on top of the inputs. Maybe a better question is, who gets the profit? What do you do with the profit? If the profit is allocated in a highly concentrated manner to just one or two people, maybe that's not the best model. Because if you said, money is energy. If it's just concentrated, welled up, that's almost like stuck energy in the body of society. But if those people that are creating that profit have an intention to spread that energy and empower others, that could be an interesting way to do it. So it's a more reallocation of that profit with an intentional manner, right?
So I agree with that, but I got to say, if we're talking about Silicon Valley and the startup world and venture capital, that does seem to be an area in which wealth is really hyper-concentrated.
That's correct.
And so then, isn't that problematic from that perspective?
It absolutely is, and that's what worries me the most in this day and time right now, because we have a few factors that are converging. One is that we have network effects, which tends to be winner-take-all, not winner-take-most. Second, that's exacerbated in real time by automation, machine learning, AI, and proprietary data. These are the new defensive moats, like oil and gas and property once was. When you combine these network effects, real-time algorithms, and then machine learning optimization, you basically dominate entire swaths, entire fields very quickly. And so you can have the vast amount of resources concentrated in the hands of just 2, 3, 4 companies. We're seeing that. Google, Amazon, Facebook, right? Because data is this new natural resource they've tied up. And the workers, the AI workers, are a scarce resource as well. My fear is that the commercial world ends up with only 5 or 6 companies that matter. In China, they have their set. Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent. In the US, we'll have our set. And that concentrates all these areas of all businesses. In the old days, General Motors just did cars. GE just did energy. These days, these mega platforms play in every area, and they're expanding their scope because every industry is turning into a data-driven industry. So that's something I have a lot of fear around. And when we have just a pure for-profit motive with stakeholders that have high concentration, literally the majority of the wealth could end up in the hands of just a dozen people.
So I think we all share your concern.
Yep.
and you are more well positioned to do something about it than most people. You know, I think a musician in Idaho is looking at the same problem being like, this sucks. You're a lot closer to it. So what are you doing?
Trying to invest in startups that have more regenerative business models that are intentional about this. Also, when possible, kind of incepting this notion of like, hey, how do we give back? One of my favorite companies, Grove Collaborative, from the very start chose to be a B Corp, and they live by that. Even though it's extra work for them to do and maintain, it's something that the founder was very principled on. And I think that's a great example.
But won't the for-profit companies always end up outperforming a company that has more costs? A company that can externalize toxic disposal to the environment is going to outperform a company that is paying money to not do that, right? Isn't that the problem with capitalism?
That's been the case until now. So here's what I'm really passionate about. I'm doing my best to explore and see if we can birth something new. Not impact capital, but maybe something newer like conscious capital. And the reason I say not impact capital is it's a term that's sort of been co-opted by many other hedge funds and investment banks as a new product for another 20 basis points. And also impact capital often denotes lower performance returns, lower tier talent, you know, sort of just NGO nonprofit type of
thing. Yeah, that seems to be the problem with it, right? You would never make the bet that was lower on all the marks, right?
Right. What if there's a different paradigm that if it is more conscious and that if we really believe you can do well by doing good, that then you can kind of have your cake and eat it too there. And so that's what I'm exploring. And it's been good to see companies like Impossible and Beyond Burger showing case studies there that, hey, there was an intention to help the world and it's done better. I have this premise and this theory that Gen Z could be our hope in this because the Greta Thunbergs of the world, they are inspiring young people to become more like activists and care and be vocal about these things. My dream is that, you know how in every food product, there is a FDA mandated nutritional label that says, here's the macros, here's nutritional content. What if there's something similar for climate impact or the carbon footprint to get this product to you, this Zoom recorder that consumed this much carbon, this much resources. And by the way, here's how Zoom offset that. And then consumers care about that. And they might even start even gamifying their stats of, hey, my purchases, the ones I chose to buy, that offset, you know, 500 tons of carbon, whatever it is, you know, that sort of thing, to get people to care about those metrics as well, right? So I think there's going to be a huge wealth shift of the incumbent brands who are just maybe more extractive or just about production consumption to a new generation of brands and companies that really pledge to be carbon neutral, sustainable, and are willing to be transparent and even audited against that, show that to consumers, and consumers will choose those brands because it's in line with their values. That's my hope and dream. And I really do think Gen Z will care about this because, frankly, eco and climate for them, it's an existential problem, not just a nice to have virtue signaling platform for like people of my generation.
You're such an interesting person to talk to because I could follow so many threads. So it's an interesting challenge for me hosting this conversation to really think about, okay, where am I going to bring you back that's going to be most useful for the audience?
Yep.
Because all of this is useful. All of it is fascinating. But where I want to come back to is, how do I get a job?
Here we go.
How do I get a job? Me right now, in this moment, I'm offering me so that it's relatable to the audience, but also universal. So, you know, not everybody necessarily has a network of festival producers as I do.
Okay.
But what's the starting place for someone who's just feeling kind of stuck, wants to get into like a new thing that's really, that maybe it's not their immediate idea of what they're passionate about per se, but something that can grow into that ikigai we talked about in the beginning.
Absolutely. This is the core question. So a couple things I've been thinking about. One is, let's look at this spectrum around this relationship with money. On the one end, there's the desperate chase for money, right? And then on the other end is more sort of the active repulsion away from it, the fear of it. I don't want it. I don't deserve it. I don't like it, right? Where is it in the middle that could be a more healthy relationship where I'm not chasing it, I'm not desperate for it, but I can sort of attract it, right? Couple ways we could explore that. One is, I mean, you have to survive. So you have to have some sort of income that you can afford to live, right? And so one thing that struck me in my life early on was, what if you can separate the way you make money from what it is that your work or your passion is, right? A lot of folks have tried to do that in the past. Like if you're the starving actor, you're waiting tables while trying to get a break, you know, that sort of thing. These days though, I wonder, with gig work and other types of employment, are there ways that, you know, you can be a Lyft driver and that affords you time to explore your creativity, your play, those sorts of other ways of what could be your ikigai, right? If you're trying to take your passion, your form of play, and having to make a living off it from the beginning as a job, sometimes that's the way to really suck the fun out of it. In my life, I remember I was trying really hard to be a musician. We once had a gig as the house band at the Hard Rock Hotel in Bali, and it was like a dream gig. They flew us there, and we're there for several weeks playing, until I realized we had to play Tracy Chapman's Give Me One Reason every night, five times a night, and let whoever in the audience wanted to come up and sing along with us, like live karaoke. I wanted to kill myself. I was like, I've never hated playing music more, because I was doing it to get that paycheck, right? And that was a really interesting kind of reveal. It's like, whoa, when you have to make money doing what you love in the form of a preformed job, that's not a whole lot of fun. Luckily, I had a job by day. I was an engineer, so I was making reasonably good money. And so I didn't have to live off of those kind of gigs, but it was eye-opening to see, like, you know what? I don't think I want to play these paid gigs if it's like a requirement of somebody else to dictate what I play, right? So that was one aha moment of, okay, I can have this income that comes from somewhere else and carve out time to explore that form of play. But to your point then, of this sort of notion of a job, I've got this framework I think a lot about. I've talked about it before, but it's your first job is to heal yourself, figure out what your core wounds, your trauma is. In doing that, you'll probably figure out some sort of superpower or adaptive strategy that's unique to you, and that frees you up to find your form of play, your best form of expression. Then with that, that's a gift you can probably give back to others, and that's the notion of then turning your form of play into service. And I think even like with this podcast, you're doing that. You're probably doing the podcast because it's out of curiosity and it is a joy to do, and you're seeking to learn from others. And by doing that, it is a gift to your community that they're learning from these folks as well. That may reveal opportunities you never thought of before. This could lead to opportunities in coaching or professional learning or curriculums or things that end up monetizing, but you never planned for it that way. You weren't chasing that. It wasn't intended to be a big profit maker. But that notion of opportunities that open up by just curiously exploring that thing you love and seeing sort of what the community or audience wants, that can lead to interesting, you know, business opportunities, I think.
Well, that's actually how I ended up ultimately in this amazing Fest 300 gig.
Uh-huh.
So people who've been listening to the show for a while, I was the creative director of a website called Fest 300, which was owned by Chip Conley. And it was a guide to the world's best festivals.
Yep.
How I got that job is I was playing music.
Yep.
As you were. I had a funky dance band called I Can Dress Myself. We took it to Burning Man. We had a Burning Man camp. And then I started volunteering for Burning Man. And I had used social media tools. This is around, you know, 2010. Yep. So when things were really picking up in that space, I was using that to promote my band. So I went to Burning Man to be like, hey, you know, I noticed that you're not using social media to promote your off-playa events. You know, that might be a place for me to volunteer. So this volunteering at something that I liked,
yeah,
to build the skills and to get noticed,
mm-hmm,
I was promoting Burning Man events. So then other producers started noticing, like, hey, who's doing that? And then I started getting some offers to do these medium-term social media marketing campaigns for street fairs and bigger events. And it started getting momentum. Wasn't making that much money, but it was starting to get momentum. And then when Chip and his co-founder, Art Gimbel, who has since passed away, wanted to start this Guide to the World's Best Festivals, they wanted someone who could build community around events.
There you go.
And they'd heard about this guy who was doing these social media marketing campaigns. And so the way that built in terms of trying something out, noticing I was good at it, volunteering, and then having the trust and patience that it might turn into something, turned into, you know, I started as a community manager, but ultimately by the time the company was sold, I was the face of the company, flying around the world, going to parties, writing about them, you know, being this professional festival enthusiast and writer, which then of course has led to this. So
this is a perfect example. I wanted to riff with you on this because this ties in something else I'm passionate about, which is find the unique and diverse set of interests of yours and skill sets and create this personal mixtape that blends things that might not have been mixed together before, but is unique to you. Example, let's take the community building part. Let's say along the way, you learned to use tools like Slack or Asana or something else like that, and you started rigging up templates and macros just for yourself first, but it turns out they're really good and useful for others. People would soon come to you and say, hey, dude, I heard you created this format. Can I start using that? Next thing you know, they might even pay you to design it, or that becomes consulting. You set up a workflow and that soon becomes like a template you even sell to others. You weren't setting out to necessarily be an entrepreneur in that space, but by figuring it out for yourself, you ended up productizing or creating something that was useful for others, right? And that would be an interesting one, because maybe folks in the festival world aren't familiar with tools like Slack or other things like that, but you happen to weave those two together in a way that was useful for you. That's what I mean by forming that mixtape of maybe divergent interests.
Well, and then the tricky part, which harkens back to what we were talking about a little while ago, is why is it that when we get to this point where someone wants to pay us, we don't know how to value ourselves. We don't know what price to offer them. It's almost like that thing I was saying about, well, I'm just happy to be here. You know, I'm getting paid for my podcast for the first time ever.
Yep.
Which is Spotify is having me do live versions of this podcast at their end of year parties in London and Stockholm.
Yep.
And they offered me a certain amount for Stockholm. And then they added London. And they said, would you want to do this just for, we'll travel and expenses, or would you like a little more money for the second appearance? And that was a moment for me where I was like, that was the moment of, I'm just happy to be here. And my partner was like, oh no, ask for this much money. I was like, but won't they think I'm being greedy? It seems like they want to maybe just do expenses and travel, but maybe I could ask for more. Well, I'll ask for less money. And what she said to me was, because I was trying to get her to help me write the email, and she's like, I'm not really interested in you writing the best email for them. I don't really want to help you write the best email. I want to help you look at why you can't ask for this money.
Beautiful question, and the exact right question to ask. Remember how we talked about profit is the value you add on top of the raw inputs? Your raw input is your energy and your time. To just get paid for travel and expenses is essentially value your time at nothing. Right. And so inherently what you do is valuable, and they're asking you for that. And they're even volunteering to provide some of that for you. So the first step is to recognize my time is valuable, right? There's opportunity cost to it. Here's a basic framework. If I was working minimum wage, my time is worth at least X amount an hour. However, what I'm doing is crafting something unique. It's worth more than minimum wage. Like, you know, hey, I think I'm doing something of value to the world that's worth a reasonable job salary of 75K or 100K a year. What would that divide out to by an hourly rate or something like that? So that's just one cut at it. Another one could be too, is what, based on their budgets, they're willing to pay. If you're able to get comparables of, oh, wow, they pay other consultants or guests or vendors this amount, I think I'm worth that, that, and that can give you that sort of confidence to say, oh, they're already paying others. I should ask for that too, because I'm of that caliber, right?
Well, and then we see how in these moments, money and self-worth have an interesting relationship.
Yes.
And an interesting growth edge.
Yes.
One of the hacks that I try to use for personal growth is to look at, the idea the obstacle is the way.
Yes.
It's not that me asking for money is hard and that's a problem. Me having the opportunity to ask for this money in this moment is revealing an issue of self-worth.
Right.
That gives me an opportunity to then make a different choice.
Right.
And actually prove to myself, wait, I am actually worth this. And I emailed them. It took me a little while to craft an email that I felt good about, and said, well, actually, I'd happy to work within your budget, but I'd like to ask for this much money.
Right.
In part because I'd be paying both of my guests when I'm traveling.
That's right.
And they responded and said, well, that sounds fair. Sure. Easy.
Boom. And this, do you remember how we talked about the chase versus attract? I think this happened because you weren't chasing it. You weren't competing for some job that they posted this thing looking for proposals and quotes for blah, blah, blah gig. You attracted this. They saw what you're doing. They came to you. That's an invitation. So already they see your value. That's very different energy than if you were applying for one slot out of many competitors.
Okay, true. But for the listener, who maybe they have an airbrush makeup project that they're doing, how do they attract that? Of course, it's always easy to say, like, if you do great work, then people will come to you. But how do we get that great work out there?
Okay, this is one of the things I've been thinking a lot about, which is back to the notion of the mixtape. Let's say you're passionate about airbrushing. Can you apply in an area or a way or a practice or a genre that the world hasn't seen before but is unique to you? Maybe like you're really into anime, and so you're really excellent at airbrushing people to look like anime characters. And it's super quirky and sounds super weird, but the thing is, it's authentic to you because you grew up as an anime fan. Guaranteed there'll be like thousands of other people that are super into it. And just by doing that thing that's a little bit offbeat, by combining those two interests of yours, you'll stand out from the crowd. I see this a lot in like TED Talks or whatnot, where people have just meshed together two divergent interests and have crafted a whole new blend. In fact, I would argue this is how artistic innovation usually happens. It's A mashed up with B, no one ever thought to mix before, that created this sort of iterative innovation. And that's really cool.
Yeah, you like put a horn on a horse and all of a sudden everything's magical.
Right? Unicorns! But I think there's something to that. So it's not to do it in a fake way that you're chasing to be noticed. It's more sort of like taking inventory of like, what turns me on? And if you see those divergent interests, then the fun job of life is to find the through line that weaves them together, that's unique to you, and that is your unique mixtape. And that's what'll get you noticed. Again, it's more attracting that as opposed to I'm chasing this sort of way.
Well, and it takes time and iteration,
yes,
too. So this podcast is an example of something that has attracted the attention of Spotify.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't my first episode that attracted their attention by any means.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for a year.
Yeah.
And super grateful to have attracted attention in a year, but it's iterative. I release a podcast. It's as good as it is.
Yep.
And then I release the next one.
Yep.
And I keep building on it and working on it.
How do you weave those curiosity and explorations into what you do at all times? Just crazy example. Let's say, you know, you're surviving by being a Lyft driver, but you wanted to be a podcaster. What if you started podcasting people, asking them, would they like to be on your Lyft podcast? I'm just, you know, brainstorming here, but can you find ways to create those spaces to explore your curiosity no matter what, all the time?
Do you know the Ira Glass quote about the gap?
Mm-mm.
Ira Glass, a famous voice, of course, from This American Life,
mm-hmm.
talks about there is this gap.
Mm.
You get into something creatively because you have a certain taste.
Yep.
And that's why you want to do it. And
yes.
That's why you know what's good.
Yes.
But there is this gap.
Yep.
And there's a gap between what you know to be good
yep.
and your ability to do it.
Yes.
And that in this quote, and I'll add it in the show notes so that it can be honored in its actual word for word because it's so beautiful, that a huge part of our job as creative people is to persist through the gap between our vision of what is beautiful and good and successful and where our skills actually are. So for me, I would say I'm still in the early stages of doing a great podcast.
Yeah.
I'm learning every time. I'm listening to myself. I can tell you right now, I am talking more on this particular podcast than I may be comfortable with. I'm tracking that as we're going, which is okay.
But I love it because we're exploring. We're literally brainstorming together. A lot of standard podcasts is some guru is dispensing wisdom, right? This is different. It's exploratory. The conversation, the questioning is the answer, as we said. That's what maybe makes this unique too, right? And so I have a talk I've given before about how to craft a beautiful life. And I was joking that I was like, well, I'll start with me. My name, Tim. Here's a formula for you. T-I-M. T, take inventory of your tastes. The more eclectic and divergent, make note of all the different ones that don't naturally fit together. Then, to your point of the gap, you imitate those masters of those tastes. You try to be like them. You reverse engineer what makes them special to you. The M part, you then mix them up, mash them up, mutate them, morph them into something that's unique to you. You meld them into something that's your unique voice. So I always come back to that, is that you are a unique collection of tastes and experiences and backgrounds only you can embody. And the mixture of those is the beauty.
Wow, I can't believe that you made an acronym out of your own name, and it totally works.
It's a little joke, yeah. But it was, again, it was sort of like, look to yourself to be the source of uniqueness in the world.
And the imitate part, I think, is helpful. You know, when I was a musician, I was playing, I can dress myself as my band, and we played a lot with a band called Planet Booty. Mm. Planet Booty is great. Shout out to the Planet Booty guys. And they did a little promo video for each of their shows. And it was so silly and fun. And so I started making the promo videos.
Love it.
And they were different. And at first they weren't as good. And now they're like a silly relic of that time in my life. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with looking at the best that's out there and starting to replicate. And then, as you say, mutate and put your own spin on it.
Exactly. And you might find other sub skills that you didn't realize was the hook. Let's say, you know, you loved music and you had a band you're really going for. As part of the band process, you had to create the posters and flyers in Photoshop. And through the process, you end up getting really good at Photoshop. Then other bands start asking you to make their posters. And then you suddenly unlock the superpower. It's like, huh, my music career isn't taking off the way I thought it would. But oh my gosh, I'm getting all these invites to do graphic design. You know,
that's exactly what happened with me with social media. I was using social media to promote my band.
Yes.
Then it was for Burning Man. Then it was for street fairs. Then it was for Fest 300.
Yes.
And now I have the same that same skill set that I developed at that time.
Yes.
I don't really want to be a social media manager.
Yep.
But I sure as hell know how to prioritize the graphics for this podcast.
Yes.
And make them look clickable and fun. I know how to write the headlines.
Yeah, yeah.
So these, you know, the time we take to build these skills, it's almost like you leverage your passion to develop skills.
I love that.
And then that's those exactly skills it. Can be used for other things.
Bingo, you nailed it. I think, and that's, again, that's the power of play and curiosity, right? You weren't trying to make it a job. You were just doing what was fun. But within that, you explored your curiosity, picked up some skills, and then that led to work. In a way, you crafted your own unique job out of it. Might not be your full-time job, could be a side hustle, could be something on Etsy that you're selling on the side, could be some consulting or other things you're doing, but it's a new door that opened up that didn't exist before.
You talk to a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yep.
And I think that there's the idea of the entrepreneur is also an interesting story
yep.
that can be helpful, but also unhelpful.
Yep.
And I think that now, you know, there's this narrative we talked about, the starving artist. But there's also this narrative of like the hustling entrepreneur.
Yep.
And what do you think that people, do you think it's helpful to consider yourself an entrepreneur in this world, in this modern climate? Should we be making these personal brands?
There are multiple stories behind why you're an entrepreneur. But the key question you have is, I think all of us should think of ourselves as innovators and entrepreneurs in some ways. Even the notion of exploring your own unique path and mixtape, you could say that's a form of entrepreneurship. Maybe it's that hero's journey of finding your artistic voice, but that could be a form of entrepreneurship too. But there are several paths I see on entrepreneurship, again, which is the why are you doing it? Classic archetypes I see. I'm doing this for shits and giggles. It's fun. I just want to create this. Oh my gosh, it took off, right? That's the curiosity play version. The other one is I need to make it in the TechCrunch headlines. I gotta get recognition. I need to be famous for this. That's sort of a more chasing one. Another one is, you know what? I was working at this company. No one seems to be doing this thing. People ask you for it. Well, my boss and other departments don't want to do it. So I think I'll just spin out and I'll do that thing because customers keep asking for it. That's an organic classic path as well, right? And yet another one is sort of like, I don't care what I build. I just want to make a unicorn and make a ton of money. That's yet another form of chasing. All these are valid paths, but they have different energies and intentions behind them. The best thing you can do is to know what is your motivating factor. I've generally found that there's kind of, I call it the three Fs. There's sort of, I can be chasing sort of fame, fortune, or freedom. I could probably maybe at max get two out of the three. I can never get all three of them. And that those different motivations might change over the course of your life as you move from scarcity to abundance, but know where on that spectrum you are.
I have an interesting relationship to the desire for fame. Mm. I grew up believing that three things would make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
To have a hot girlfriend, to be popular, and to be famous.
Yep.
And I didn't think about it in exactly those words because that's pretty garish, but those were motivations in me. Hot girlfriend, popular, famous. And
many people probably have the same, but won't admit it.
Yeah. Well, and of course I wouldn't admit it in that way at that time. But the very first time I drank ayahuasca, one of the biggest revelations for me was that those three things represented deep desires. But what I was looking at were facsimiles of the original desire.
Mm.
So I didn't want a hot girlfriend. What I wanted was deep connected love with spontaneous sexual play.
Yes.
Just real alive connection.
Yeah.
But I extrapolated that to be a hot girlfriend.
Yes.
Popularity, I didn't want to be a popular kid. What I wanted was to belong to a vibrant community of interesting creative people that I admired. And then fame, I didn't want to be Kim Kardashian famous, but I wanted to be really admired for my work. And I wanted to be in play in my work. I wanted to be collaborating with other people I respected. And I wanted to be known.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that hot girlfriend, popular, famous, those are weird things to try to get. And they're kind of like the goalpost moves.
Right.
Well, I got a hot girlfriend. Is she hot enough?
Right.
Like I'm popular, but I'm not popular with these people. I'm famous, but I'm not this famous. Whereas the deeper desires, I can say that I have all three of those, actually. You know, I'm part of an artistic community that matters to me. I have a partner that I feel very connected with, and I'm doing something that is attracting attention to what people care about. Because when we're talking about money and jobs and career, what we're really talking about is an alive, joyful life.
There you go. And there's purpose and meaning behind it. Because what you're really getting at is the cardinal questions. Who am I? What do I really want? And what's really important is when you double click on those questions, they're like onion layers you can go infinitely deep upon. Like you could say, what do you want? Well, I want hot girlfriend. Why? Why do you want that? If you keep double clicking on the why behind the what you want, it reveals so much. Often it'll be tied to some core wound or some trauma or some lack that you've had, right? And understanding that is so, so critical. Even again, to who am I? That's a story. You know, in meditation or other introspective work, I keep finding that whatever I come up with an answer of who am I is not much more than a story I've been co-creating with the world, not much more real than a character in a play. You can deconstruct that and remove the onion layers of that as well. You can go all the way down the rabbit hole till you realize, whoa, I'm nobody. I'm everybody. I'm God, him or herself, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is beautiful that you pointed out. That meta-questioning of what's behind your desires reveals so much. It often does reveal those core wounds that you're trying to reparent and heal.
I want to bring into the conversation in this moment the Life is a Festival community on Facebook, which you're a part of.
Yes, thank you for
great.
That.
Yeah, you are a part of this community and you've participated in it. And it's actually been really rewarding for me because actually bringing in some of my social media community management skills to Life is a Festival, I recognize that people want to connect with each other. People are listening to this podcast. They're really feeling a connection with the guests. They're learning some things. It's fun. It's entertaining. And then where do you go from there? Oh, well, you can actually talk to other people who care about this.
Totally.
So that's part of what I've been crafting. And so part of the contract between me and this community is that this isn't one-way broadcasting. It's not that the community serves Life as a Festival. It's that we're building something together. And so when you are, as a listener, investing your time listening, investing your time offering questions for my guests, investing your time collaborating, that I'm investing my time back. And one of the ways that I'm wanting to do that is actually pulling some questions for my guests, which is pretty cool.
I love that. That's great.
So Michael Coleman had a question that I think really I really value and makes a lot of sense in the context of this conversation, which he's curious to hear about your perspective on people who work for themselves, i.e. freelancers or contractors, versus work for a company in-house. I do think there's kind of a unique challenge for contractors and freelancers versus people who work in-house.
Extremely so, because if you work for yourself, you have to be crystal clear on your value you bring to the table, your identity, your skill set, and your self-worth. That notion of what you charge and why and how you justify that has to be pretty solid, right? As opposed to when you work in-house for a company, you're an employee. There's a predefined role, there's a predefined salary. In many ways, you don't have to do that work. You don't have to think about it. A company's taking care of it. So working for yourself is arguably harder in many ways because you have to be really clear on who you are and what your value is there. I think long term, there could be an interesting future where it's either you work for one of these giant mega platform companies like Google or Facebook or whatnot, or you are working for yourself and that, you know, half the population is more entrepreneur slash gig worker or freelancer. And you have to be clear on what your particular artistic voice is, your value you bring to the table.
Here's a little question about gig work. And this is from my friend, Michael Norman. Do you know Michael?
I do. He's great.
He's great. He's awesome, dude. He brought up something that I think is a great question to ask you. For people listening to the podcast who are potentially interested in having skills that are useful in the gig economy down the road, what special insight do you have in your relationship to companies and technology in your role with Mayfield? What special insight do you have that would allow you to advise them on skills to develop for the future gig economy?
Absolutely. This will be really interesting because what gig economy is enabled by and threatened by is increasing automation and unbundling through technology, right? Because, well, let's give an example. First one was ride sharing. The first job is driving cars for Lyft or Uber. Those cars are going to be self-driving pretty soon. What is the nature of the human in the car at that point? Might they be delivery agent? That's happening now. They're becoming DoorDash drivers or picking up and dropping off meals. Might be it's then packages. Perhaps then the driver in the car over time becomes a different role. They're not really driving, but are they a concierge? Are they a game show host? Are they something else? You know, there'll be other forms of work or labor as the cars become more robotic and more self-sufficient. I actually think after AI and robotics automates a lot of the menial tasks that perhaps are not as enjoyable. That frees us up to be more focused on making art, making love, healing, serving each other. That's an interesting form of gig work. Like, what if you...
Making love?
Yeah. Isn't it? That's, to me, sort of like witnessing each other, being in relation to each other, coaching, helping, healing, those sorts of things, right? Those are all forms of love to me, right?
But I'm just being cheeky, really. I don't think sex work is illegitimate by any means. I think sex work... Actually, I think sex work is something that is going to change in terms of the gig economy.
I think so, too, because it might not even be about sex. What's the underlying root behind what you want to feel from it?
Connection.
Connection. So here was something interesting I learned from a woman who was a pioneer in VR adult content. She thought it was about the simulacra of the sexual acts in VR. It turns out with that level of intimacy, it was more about deep connection. She had to find different performers who were better at eye gazing and closeness and communication, because a lot of those early alpha testers weren't even interested in the physical act. It was the connection part of it, right? So that forms different forms of work. You're familiar with Zendo, right? Peer support.
Yeah. Why don't you let the audience know if they're not familiar?
So Zendo is a camp working with MAPS that provides psychedelic peer support at places like Burning Man, people going through challenging times. You know, that is the ultimate form of holding space for others. But imagine a form of job in the future. Gig work is Zendo on demand. You're holding space for others, whether it's psychedelic challenging times or anything that, oh, there's a company called Seven Cups that does this as well. But this could be a form, again, love, making love, if you will, just holding space for others, helping others, right? Similar things you see in AA circles, but to have access to that network all the time will be a legitimate form of work and service, right? So I'm really keen on these aspects where we're going to be looking for connection, authentic expression, and serving each other and healing. That's all that's really left after AI is automating away, again, some of the menial tasks. And maybe that is a new age of abundance that we have. And back to the thing I said before, your only job in that future is to heal yourself so you're free to play and then find ways to play in service.
We're going to have to get the governance on that right, though.
Oh,
big
time.
We're going to have to, whether it's some kind of UBI version, like what it is that allows that abundance to be shared.
That's
correct. Because we don't have the model right now.
That's
correct. The model is totally wrong right now.
That's right.
And this kind of dovetails with an entirely separate conversation I wanted to have with you. And I think you mentioned Zendo, psychedelic peer support. But I'm really interested in the topic of psychedelic therapy.
Yep.
Did you read We Will Call It Paula?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So We Will Call It Paula is a short story that is a fictionalized account of a psychedelic therapy startup. And it goes through from this woman's deeply passionate aspiration to heal the world through psychedelic medicine through the path of a venture-backed startup competing with other startups. And it shows some of the powerful pitfalls that may lie in wait for the psychedelic community through this model. And I'm going to pair that with another thing that I saw recently, which is Dennis McKenna talking about how the medicalization of psychedelics actually will lead to the logical outcome is that these will be VC-backed unicorns, or it's going to go into the hands of Big Pharma, and that he was recommending that kind of a religious adoption of psychedelics was actually a preferable space. So I wanted to talk to you about, because I know that you're very interested in consciousness hacking. I am sure that you as a VC have looked at the space of psychedelic medicine.
Yep.
And I really want to have a conversation about this because psychedelics are by their very nature subversive. You know, and if we're trying to create a way that it's a medicalized psychedelic therapy experience that is defanged from some of its more weird, unusual, mystical aspects that we who use them recreationally or for our own inquiry are, that's part of what we're looking for. Isn't this VC-backed model for psychedelics going to end in disaster for this technology?
It very much could. And the hope, maybe the requirement of this space is that people working in it adapt a different model and mindset than what came before. Because if you think about what a lot of people experience through psychedelic therapy or the psychedelic medicines, this notion of connectedness, inclusiveness, empathy, compassion, that is abundance mindset. It's a whole different playbook than often sort of extractive or scarcity-driven capitalism, winner-take-all types of things. you would hope it stands to reason that people working in this field would be trying to embody with their investment and their businesses the very values that these medicines unlock. But there will be forces coming from the outside. I see it now, former cannabis and crypto bros saying, dude, psychedelics is a hot new area, man, coming in with the same playbooks from before. And although, you know, Michael Pollan's book has made the zeitgeist of psychedelics at an all-time high, everyone's interested in it. We're seeing decriminalization, legalization efforts. This, in some ways, is the most dangerous period of all because all these different energies are coming into the space and there's not alignment around what the ethics, the integrity, the values are around it. Right. There's probably an important need for leadership councils and industry associations of the best practitioners and thought leaders in the space to align different values for this. That doesn't exist yet. I love what Rick and gang are doing at MAPS, but they have to stay razor focused on the clinical path, on FDA approval. And that's all they can manage with just MDMA right now. They don't have room or bandwidth to do these other parts. You know, luckily some brilliant thought leaders like Liana at MAPS is already thinking about this in terms of that, you know, organization and synchronization of these values. But man, everyone recognizes this is needed. We don't want to let the space become the wild, wild west, especially as competing money interests come in it. This is a hot topic right now because you're going to see companies that come in with venture backing just trying to do the standard biotech playbook. Oh, let's create a new isomer of this particular compound, patent it, and charge the hell out of it and maximize profits, right? That stands antithetical to democratization of access for these things. Furthermore, unlike traditional healthcare, this space will live and die by the success of the therapists in the space. Many of those were underground therapists before. You know, they're not necessarily the most resourced or skilled or trained in how to run clinics or achieve funding for that. So they need to be empowered to run this in the right way. Different than cannabis. Cannabis, you can just get it at a dispensary. There's no need for a clinician or a therapist to administer that. And already, I've got fears in how this can be rolled out as it's sort of co-opted by regular healthcare systems, because we've got ketamine clinics already that administer it in the most sterile of settings. You go in there and it's the fluorescent harsh light and they give you that dose just like they would give you any other sort of prescription drug. And then the doctor walks out of the room and you're there left having this extraordinary experience with no set setting or support. Furthermore, no integration afterwards, right? Something I believe very much in this space from my research is that the molecule is not the medicine. That's sort of the doorway that opens up. The real medicine is all the integration work you do afterwards.
That's why ceremony is such a powerful model for this. You know, an ayahuasca ceremony has their different versions. They're sent to Daime in Brazil. There are different groups that do it in different ways. But ultimately, there is a shamanic container created by a practitioner who has been deeply studied in the Ikaros, the music that creates the space. There are certain rules and agreements. And I would never take ayahuasca at a party. I would never take ayahuasca and just like be in the world because it's such a potent medicine and it really works in that container. And I think that the big win in terms of psychedelic medicine is actually drawing on indigenous wisdom traditions.
Back to the importance of diversity we talked about before, inclusiveness of all that has come before and the wisdom they have there. Because if you think about it, in many ways, us spiritual hipsters out there, they've co-opted this plant medicine from other cultures and sort of made it their own, you know what I mean? Without necessarily respecting those indigenous cultures and that wisdom that they bring to the table, right? Especially as it goes to mainstream healthcare, they're not used to incorporating indigenous shamanic traditions and those sorts of things.
But, you know. Well, and a lot of the peoples that are closest to some of these medicines, Iboga in the Congo Basin or peyote, some of these medicines that are most endangered as medicines, their stewards are also the most marginalized groups of people.
Correct.
As well. And so for us to take psychedelic medicine and kind of pluck it out of the indigenous context and put it in a medical setting in the motif of extractive capitalism is almost the biggest cosmic joke about what the promise of psychedelic medicine really is. Because for me, the promise of psychedelic medicine is not to cure your depression. The promise of psychedelic medicine is to help heal the human experience at the root of your depression, but at the root of all of this, you know, environmental degradation.
That's right.
And the shitty ways we treat each other.
Yeah.
So if it's pulled out of the indigenous context, put in this sterilized medical setting for the sake of profit, haven't we just fucked one of the most valuable tools that's become available for us?
Yeah. Liana often uses this term, which I really like, which is psychedelic business practices. how can you embody, again, the values and the insights that these medicines tend to provide for people in how you even work with them, how you invest in them, how you build businesses, how you structure governance, and how you even have the business models designed for that. What you've just highlighted is the key opportunity and biggest risk in this whole space, right? So that's why we need investors who are conscious about this, founders who are deeply aligned with what you're trying to do. And so, but this is a hotly debated topic. I've had discussions with folks who just come out of the clinical psychiatry world and saying, you know what? We just need scale of as many clinicians as possible certified because we need national coverage so that insurance will reimburse it so we get it to as many people as possible. Okay, yeah, I get that. But they would go as far as to say, I don't care if that therapist has tried the psychedelic medicine or not. I just need them to be certified and trained in it. I don't need to be schizophrenic to treat a schizophrenic. I think that's a false analogy. I think there's a whole different modality with a different pathway. And so I don't like that viewpoint. It doesn't make sense to me that a psychedelic therapist wouldn't have undergone this medicine before, you know, being fully certified to give that treatment.
Are you or Mayfield invested in any psychedelic therapy initiatives at all?
Starting to look at it, obviously, you know, with its legal gray zone, we can't make investments in areas that aren't fully legalized yet. However, there's going to be enabling tech platforms that help the space. For example, how do you enable the therapists? Maybe you are building platforms and tools that help therapists of all kinds that would apply to psychedelic therapists down the road. And so you can sort of build for that superset problem and then have it be more specified for psychedelic therapists as they become above ground versus underground as it gets more legalized.
Here's a really great way to tie this into our earlier conversation.
Yep.
I'm looking for a new gig.
Mm.
I love my podcast.
Yep.
It's going great.
Yep.
I want it to continue to grow.
Yep.
But to your point about not wanting to play the Bali gig,
yep.
If I'm trying to wring money out of this podcast, I'm going to be interrupting every 10 seconds to try to sell mattresses.
Yep.
Not what I want to do.
Right.
But I want a new gig. There are two things that have really attracted me in the past 2 years. One, we've talked about, not in this podcast, but men's work.
Yep.
The other is psychedelic medicine, mm-hmm. and psychedelic stewardship broadly. Yep. And so for me, I would love to launch a new guide to the world's best festivals, but a guide to the world's ceremonies and psychedelic experiences. Mm. That'd be a great venture. I'd love to work with ketamine therapy. I've been in a conversation about potentially doing that. But here I am wanting to potentially launch something. And I find myself in the same challenge as the protagonist of We Will Call It Paula, which is, I need to make money. I need to make a living. I need to make things work. And I also need to balance my integrity in this space. So if I were to launch something in the psychedelic space, I would immediately come into invariably a kind of competition mindset with all the other startups that are trying to make their name in this space, because the very nature of the ecosystem itself is competitive. And then how can I cut my costs so I can outperform them? When I think about that whole prospect, it makes me not want to do it.
Right.
And I imagine that there are many other people like myself who are more embedded in the psychedelic community who are also looking at that and being like, do I want to compete with a bunch of naive tech bros who are willing to do whatever it takes to win the day and they may ultimately win it? Should I start a business in the psychedelic space? I don't know how to answer that question because I'm so worried about the sensitivity of the space itself. And then also balancing that with, like, how do I create success?
Yep, exactly. What this gets down to is a couple questions is, what does the space need to grow and thrive? That'll reveal a whole host of white space that solutions need to be built. But the real key question with that is, what is the model, the business model I want to put with it that can be more intentional and inclusive? We usually assume that there's only one or two typical business models we have, advertising based or, you know, like a maximum profit based.
Selling people's data.
Yeah, right.
What Selling if we, people's psychedelic data.
So here it is. What are psychedelic business models, regenerative models that benefit the community and the therapists that still provide for good livings, but maybe is not just about maximization of profit in the hands of a few? So it takes craft to think about the model you want to apply to it. This is similar because when you started your podcast, you weren't just trying to make maximum money from ads and everything else, but by doing it authentically, you attracted interesting opportunities. Can that playbook be used in this way too? You've got this sort of North Star of values that you have carefully studied what the space needs. You know what the intentions are behind that. And then, so you're always in service to that. As you do that, perhaps, you know, monetization opportunities open up in a more aligned way.
So I'm going to have you back on the podcast in, don't know, maybe a year, yep. some amount of time. And we're just going to go deep on this psychedelic thing because I think you and I will both have evolved in our relationship to it at that point. You know, because really this is two conversations at once. I wanted to touch on the psychedelics, but this is worth doing a really gnarly deep dive. So I'm going to bring it back. And as a way of finishing the podcast and closing out our experience together, as a successful venture capitalist advising me, an entrepreneur who has created a podcast called Life is a Festival, it's gotten some acknowledgement. It's won some hearts and minds. It has an ecosystem. What would you do with this podcast?
Great question. I would look at how you've curated some wonderful resources and learnings and people for the community and be curious about what the community naturally wants to follow up on. I bet you with every guest you've had on, there's been at least some subset of audience members saying, I want to go deeper on that. I want to take that course. Or is there a book they have? Could you point me in the right direction? This person mentioned three things they buy. Can you send me a link to that? Right? Once you win that trust and you believe in that story, there's almost a notion of maybe coaching or help that people want from that person, that expert or thought leader, right? Because one thing I really believe in a lot is that you win trust from a community with radical transparency. You make money through irresistible convenience and follow-up. I'll give you a quick example. There was a company I'd invested in a while ago called 3D Robotics. Literally, just a hobbyist community of people doing do-it-yourself drones. And it was open source. It was like, here's how you build your own drone out of Legos. Here's the list of parts. And then here it is, all free. Download whatever you want. Invariably, people started saying, can you just sell me the bag of parts? And then it was, could you just sell me the finished drone? So that's what I meant. Radical transparency, giving it all away, showed people that your incentives and motives were in the right place and you were just trying to help them out. The convenience part is where you made the money from it, the follow-up. So in the space of podcasts and knowledge and learning and self-transformation, a lot of the times we are giving information, we're trying to give pointers and tools and resources to people to become better versions of themselves. The truth is, though, that requires a lot of willpower to do it yourself. What you really want is an accountability partner, a coach, a concierge, a curator, and you want help in that journey. And a lot of times you're willing to pay for that as well. It's not just tell me what to do, please help me do it. Maybe to start off, do it for me to get rolling on that. That's how nutritionists work. That's how fitness trainers work. It's how life coaches work. It's how many of these things do work. And that's a natural opportunity that could lead to monetization. Because you're so curious and you're transparent about this, you're genuinely trying to curate the best stuff, not because you're trying to make a buck. You're not just talking about somebody, some things that pay you the most. You're literally drawn by your interests and, you know, your values on what's interesting to you and the community. If they trust that, they'll want to follow up. They'll say, hey, you've curated some of the best in this area. Can you give me a recommendation? I'm willing to buy through you, you know, and you deserve a commission through that because I know you're not just offering the thing that pays the most to you, right? So you've been radically transparent about that. That will lead to monetization opportunities that open up because of the community's desire to follow up on this and implement it in their own lives.
Well, and here's how I have to challenge my own limitations too. Which is not just that I deserve to make a living doing this thing that I love, but also that people want more opportunities and that by creating some kind of funnel that supports me financially, I'm actually able to grow Life as a Festival beyond the podcast. You know, right now, Life as a Festival is being subsidized by some money my grandmother gave me for my education that is slowly dwindling, right? That's what's happening right now. So this podcast, this community, this idea that we can approach personal growth through adventure, which is essentially the core of this, deserves to grow. And I and this community deserve to have the adventure of it growing. That doesn't necessarily mean it can or should be my main gig, but it means that as I look at my limitations around monetization, who does that serve?
That's right.
Who does my guilt around privilege, my, oh, I don't deserve this, who does that serve? Because it doesn't serve the people who want to pay for the more enhanced experience you're describing.
That's right. Let's deep dive in this a little bit. So you just kind of brainstorm here a little bit. What if you use radical transparency, even about your relationship with money? Guys, this is what it costs me to make this. This is what's in my bank account. This is what I spend each month. help me do this more. I'm starving, but this is what it would take to help me make this full-time gig. Come up with ideas with me. This is what I want to charge, and this is how I'd use that money. I'd flow that back, not to my bank account, but to reinvest in this, and here's my budget and operating plan. What do you guys think?
Well, that's part of when I responded to Spotify asking for more money, one of the things I said is, I'm going to be compensating both of my guests.
Yep.
You know, I'm being paid to do this. This is a performance of a podcast. So I'm going to be compensating my guests. And I think that transparency was also part of why they were like, oh, well, that's fair.
Totally.
You know, so would you recommend like the Patreon model?
I was about to go there next, is that this notion of micro patronage is a beautiful one. Artists before used to have to live on just one rich family or one rich patron. But with digital tip jars and platforms like Patreon, you can have contributions from many folks. And what I've often seen in this world is, it doesn't matter if you have 100 fans or 1,000, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 7% are generally willing to convert to a paid micro patron on an ongoing basis. That's beautiful, because that means that you can just have a subset of your audience that is there for you all the time, that wants to support you, especially with more transparency and more authenticity around it.
Okay, so there's two places that I get hung up on the Patreon thing. Sure. And why I haven't created it.
Sure.
One, I don't want to burden the podcast with heavy selling. So I don't want it to be like, ding, 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 it's time for Patreon. And I guess that's something that I can kind of get over and I can do in a balanced way. So that's one. The other thing is, as I understand it, part of how you do a Patreon is that you are creating exclusive content. And I don't really want to make exclusive content. You know what I mean? I guess that's a way to think about it. And maybe, and I'm not beholden to this idea. Maybe at some point I'll create exclusive content. But I'm interested in growing Life as a Festival, creating an inclusive community. So subscriber-only content to me feels like I'm doing work to meet less people. So I wouldn't want to take away from what people are getting. So it would represent a whole new thing that I would need to create for those people.
Possibly, but maybe even in this format, we're doing like 2 hours of raw recording. You're going to have to edit it heavily to something that's a little more palatable. But for a hardcore fan, they might want this entire unfiltered conversation. So that's one that could fit in the existing workflow. That's just one example. The other is maybe, again, the hyper transparency. Hey guys, I'm inviting you this journey for me. Help me brainstorm this. I need to make, I don't know, $2,000 a month off this to make a living or whatever it is. I'm at 1500. What do you think? You know, and like literally asking for ideas and being hyper transparent about that. And my friend Rob Reed did that with his Patreon, is basically say, hey, for me to keep doing this and get you better content and to make a living off, so I don't have to do with this other gig work or take this full-time job, I need to make this much and here's where I'm at. Thank you. You know, that sort of thing. So that was sort of that hyper-transparency about it, and inviting the audience to sort of like brainstorm with you on those sorts of things. That could be pretty interesting.
Well, and I like the Patreon model much more than Kickstarter. Yeah. Because Kickstarter, I never did a Kickstarter, even with my band or with Burning Man camps or whatever, because that was always like, you ask your community to come in to make the Kickstarter with you. So ask to help the video, to create the things that you're going to give away. So there's this real drain on the community for the Kickstarter just to get it up. And then it's like, hey, can you give money? And can you share this with your friends? And I have a pretty lofty goal because I've just spent all this time doing a Kickstarter. And I like the Patreon a little bit better. And I like Amanda Palmer's approach to Patreon, to asking for what you need. And also kind of saying, hey, I want this to be in the world, and I spend, you know, 8 to 10 hours a week. I record, I listen, I pay my designer, Andy, to make these rad graphics, and help me do this.
Exactly. You know, it's inviting them in the conversation, revealing what's behind the curtain, even revealing the numbers. I think, again, you win trust with that too. Another form could be asking for help from the community, not monetarily, but maybe with leads or ideas. Guys, if you like the
format, I always do that. I have no shame in doing that.
But sometimes that's more rewarding than the direct monetary contribution. For example, hey guys, if you know companies that are interested in building out their ecosystem and would like somebody to do these kind of podcasts with, you know, thought leaders or folks they want to feature, like the Spotify gig I have, send me leads your way. You know what I do. Send them samples of my work.
So are you saying that I should ask that now on this podcast? Hey guys. By the way, I'm trying to get hey guys out of my language.
Yeah.
Trying to remove hey guys. Folks, my people.
My peeps.
My community. Everybody. My all tribe. All y'all. I'm looking for gigs. I'm looking for new opportunities. If you know somebody who is doing something really cool and wants creative support, I am down to check out lots of opportunities. I'm down to see what's available and jump in and learn things and contribute.
Let me do this for you.
Okay.
People, Eamon is one of the top community builders I've ever seen in terms of offline, online. Every company now realizes they need to be building ecosystems, partnerships, not just audiences, but communities of their users. And they need folks like Eamon who know how to facilitate these dialogues, assemble people, create events and gatherings. So if you know of companies out there, and you must, because every company now has to be in the ecosystem building game, come recommend Eamon's work to them and try to see if there are companies interested in community builders. I guarantee you there are. Many of my own portfolio companies, community manager is one of the top needs they have.
Thank you. And it's still an edge for me, because even while you're doing that, I'm like, but I don't need anything. I would do it alone, you know, but that's the problem. And that's where we need to heal our relationship to money, to success, to career. We don't need to do it alone. That's the whole point, you know?
Yeah, right.
We do need to be honest about our needs and get the support of those around us.
Oh, and on top of that, it might not be have to be a full-time job or gig. It could be advisory roles for equity, could be consulting by the hour. There's many configurations and permutations this could be. But the point is, community building is something that many, many institutions value now. And it's a skill, it's a joy, it's a form of play, it's a superpower you've cultivated.
Wow. Well, you know, that feels like a good place to land
yeah.
on this particular conversation on this particular Tuesday in San Francisco. Wow. I really enjoyed that.
My pleasure. This is a lot of fun. This is literally exploring the topic by just kind of dancing with it and literally brainstorming on the fly.
Yeah. Well, and it was fun because I listened to some different podcasts of you because I know you, but not, I know you personally, less in terms of the full scope of your work. And all of them were different. All of them were kind of like different subject matter and different conversations, which is something I really admire about you. And I didn't know exactly how this conversation would go. It actually ended up being much more conversation than interview. I didn't necessarily expect that, but I guess I had a lot to say as well. But you did not disappoint, Tim.
Oh, thank you.
Great job.
Yeah.
I will be your parent and tell you you killed it.
Thank you. That means a lot to me, actually.
Thank you for joining us on Life is a Festival. If you enjoyed this episode, you can support it by sharing it with your friends and leaving a review on iTunes, letting us know what you thought. If you'd like to keep up with me, you can visit my website, EamonArmstrong.com. That's E-A-M-O-N Armstrong.com, or Eamon Armstrong on your favorite social platform. Thanks for tuning in. Together, we can make life a festival for everyone. See you on the dance floor. Whirlwind stash free, no time selling. I stole. You're killing me. I'll tell you what a B knocker. If Hulk Hogan didn't sport as a partner, song dedicated to the mustache rocker. Mahatma Gandhi, MLK type. Baby, you know that you so fly, yo. When you rock the style like Frida Kahlo. Some say it's cheesy like Asiago, but I don't think so. It's rock and roll. Chaplin, old Fu Manchu, all been hot damn like a chimney fan. Tim.
Yes, sir.
How did the podcast go?
This was great. I love this because we got to explore questions that I didn't have a handy answer for, and really gnarly ones too that probably have no handy answer. And so that's actually what I was hoping to get out of it, is to learn something new, challenge the edge of my thinking, explore something new, come up with other questions, you know, to maybe explore in future podcasts, or even as I have these conversations with other friends to use in future dialogues.
Yeah, I felt that way too. I felt like the conversation meandered in a really delightful way.
Yeah.
And like we really went into some important conversations about venture capital, mm-hmm. about privilege. And I think that when we're talking about abundance and healing your relationship to money, there are often so many holes in that conversation, yep. privilege being one of the big ones.
Right.
So I feel really good about the fact that we had a broader scope and bounced around a lot.
And I also wanted to make sure it wasn't just too judgmental against privilege, right? Because that point of, look, privileged people have trauma too. They have their challenges as well. Be kind.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, and it's, we all have these different perspectives. And I think everyone, with the exception of people with some major kind of structural damage in their brain, everyone is endeavoring to be a better person on the terms that they understand.
I also find the cure for privilege is finding a form of service, right? Giving back. Mm. And if you can tie that into your true form of play, the thing that brings you greatest joy, that's an awesome recipe for life.
Yeah. Serve in the way that feeds you most.
Bingo.
Was there anything on the podcast? Was there anything you feel like we missed on the podcast? Is there anything on this subject of career and money and that you really wanted to touch on that we missed?
There was one thing I was thinking about, which was this notion of a quote unquote career versus what it is that you do. There's a framework in this conscious leadership group that many of my friends are in, Diana Chapman's book, you know, Principles of Conscious Leadership. And the framework is this. First, you go through a stage where things happen to you. You're kind of a victim or a recipient of things of life. Then you evolve to things happen by you. You're an agent. You have agency. You're making things happen. But the ultimate form is things happen as you. And that's kind of a weird one, but it implies that you become sort of this vessel, that it's not even your agenda. It's just things are flowing through you, especially when you're really aligned with your purpose.
There's a Lakota expression that I love for this, which is, we are the bone flute through which spirit plays.
Oh, love that one. That's so good.
Isn't it good?
I've been thinking about this is, how do we find that alignment with ourselves and what we do in every moment? And one time I experienced this is, like, if you work with a master healer sometimes, body worker, whatever it is, they don't have a notion of career. They're not even thinking about advancing their LinkedIn profile or whatever. It's almost like the work they do is just an expression of who they are. Their gift is who they are, and they just do it each day. You know, they give that massage, which is masterful, and there's no point to it other than it's just expressing their gift. And so that was kind of a moment where I realized, ooh, that's an example of, like, you know, things happen as you.
Yeah, and I do feel though we have to earn the flow. You know, there are rough edges that we work on, and things are not separate. You know, healing your relationship with money is also healing your relationship with yourself, your own wounded child.
Yes.
You know, to be able to believe that you have something to offer the world that you can create an exchange of energy around requires a inward look and understanding why is this hard for me? Where's this pain coming from?
Totally. I think you nailed it so much with this notion when you examine, like, oh, I want the hot girlfriend, I want the recognition. When you really dig underneath the why, what is it you want to feel from it? That might be a clue as to how to heal your relationship with money. It's not the money you really want. There's something deeper beneath it. It's to be seen. It's to be witnessed, to be recognized, to be valued for what you bring to the table.
Well, yeah. And for me, this podcast is a huge part of what I want when I think of money and career. I'm sitting down here this afternoon talking to you, and we're having a conversation that has the heightened energy that it's going to be listened to. And the podcast has gained enough regular listeners that I know that there's going to be a couple hundred, 1,000, probably more than that, who are just listening to this because it's the next podcast and they don't know who you are, they don't know what they might learn from you, and are suddenly walking away being like, oh shit, this problem I've been chewing on, I think about it this way,
right?
And then changes.
Yep.
And for me, when I think about money and career and life, I want to be in the flow of that dynamic.
Totally.
I want to create something that means something.
Totally.
I think we all do.
If you keep exploring that topic with this podcast and other folks who have walked that path, you'll unlock some things for yourself. As you figure that flow out for yourself, suddenly people come to you and say, hey, can you coach me on this? That's a whole nother opportunity too. Even though you weren't setting out to be a career coach or something like that, by figuring it out, unlocking it for yourself, that becomes the gift you can provide to others. That inherently is a value. And people might even come to you and invite you to say, I'm willing to pay you $500 an hour to help me with this. I'm stuck with this.
And in order to make that work, we have to be willing to accept that money.
Yeah.
We have to be willing to say, yeah, you know what? My time is worth that. Your time is worth me being focused.
That's right.
Let's try it. And it's not going to be perfect. You iterate. It gets better over time. But getting past that first stage of fear and unworthiness.
Yep.
And to say, you know what, Spotify? I'll take that money for Sweden, but I think that I deserve to also be compensated a certain amount for the other appearance as well. And I'm going to share that money around, and it's going to be worth your time. And what ends up happening with the Sweden gig, with the Spotify gig, is that me saying, no, I do want this extra amount of money, lets them know that I'm serious, that I'm professional, and that I'm going to show up fully. Because I've said, I want this.
That's right.
This is my value.
Yep.
That tells them that I'm going to show up fully. It also tells me that I'm going to show up fully.
Yep.
If I say, oh, you know what? I'll do the whole thing just for the travel. That's a little different thing for me than I better show up like I'm getting paid.
That's right. And it makes you perform better, right? Because there's higher stakes at the table too. Ups your game. I have an idea from this. What if this leads to a set of like dinner salons for our community around money? It's a topic nobody wants to talk about, but I often get asked by friends, like, what do you do with your money, man? How do you invest it? How do you manage it? And then I've hosted several dinner salons on this, not for any gain of me, my own. I'm not trying to sell anything. I'm just literally sharing my story of, hey, this is kind of hacks I figured out. I hope it helps you. What are hacks you figured out? It's a topic that no one feels safe to talk about, but everybody needs and wants to learn from, because we don't teach financial literacy anywhere in our system. I went to Stanford Business School. They never taught us how to manage our own money, balance our own checkbook. That's inane to me.
I love that you can create things for different value creation. And when you're talking about dinners that discuss financial literacy, you don't want to make money, but what you are making is community.
Yeah.
You are bringing people to break bread with
totally.
You. And I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think we should see
I want our kids
it.
In the future to learn this too. They're not taught that, right? Heal some of this money trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tim, thanks for coming to my house and helping me heal my money trauma. And in all likelihood, I will launch this podcast with a Patreon account.
Right on.
So
love it.
I haven't committed to it firmly yet. I need to think about it.
But there you go.
Why not? Huh? Why not? What could go wrong?
Why not? Right. I have this crazy dream someday where we all are willing to be so vulnerable that we can be open source personal finance. Like, imagine this sort of like, hey, tribe. This is, my personal balance sheet and cash flow and whatnot, and this is my intentions with it. I think I can live in the Bay Area, have a pretty good life with, $125,000 a year, and here's how I spend it, and I want to give the rest away, or I want to invest or serve you guys, help me with this. What do you think? Wouldn't that be really interesting? Because we're so close source on it because people are so fearful of it.
Wow. That's a pretty radical perspective. Maybe there's a business idea there.
Maybe.